from WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Sarah Dennis with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, March 21st. The U.S. Department of Education is investigating the University of South Florida over its involvement in the McKnight Doctoral Fellowship Program, which provides scholarships for African American and Hispanic students. The program aims to boost minority representation in higher education, but it's being questioned for offering race-based funding. This investigation is a part of a larger push against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in universities. USF has been asked to provide data on scholarship recipients by March 31st. This Sunday, March 23rd, at noon, postal workers and supporters will rally in St. Petersburg to protect the U.S. Postal Service from privatization. The event, organized by the National Association of Letter Carriers, will take place at Tyrone Boulevard and 66th Street. The organizers say they stand in solidarity to keep the Postal Service public and accessible to all Americans. The rally is happening in response to ongoing threats of privatization, as there are concerns that the Postal Service could be dismantled and sold off to private companies. Manatee County is teaming up with the Fire Watch to offer training that helps residents recognize when veterans are in crisis and connect them with the support they need. The goal is to train 300 community members to become watchstanders, helping the county earn a Veteran Safe Community designation, with hopes to engage up to 700 participants. The Fire Watch's Veteran Safe Place program also trains businesses to spot signs of distress among veterans. Training sessions are scheduled for March 26th, April 29th, and May 29th in Bradenton, with virtual options available on April 8th and May 9th. This has been Sarah Dennis with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, March 21st.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 Low Power FM in Bradenton, Florida. I'm Steve Norris, and this is the Surreal News Show. Today, on our show, former CIA analyst and whistleblower Mel Gordon will discuss the Sovietization of the United States. Senior strategist for Free Press Tim Carr will discuss today the ways that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is being weaponized. And today, the co-host is Nancy Norris, and she'll be reporting on medical and science news. The opinions heard today are not those of WSR or WBPV board members or its employees, just to the persons who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest.
As public funding for this and other independent radio stations and media have recently vanished, it appears that the delivery of information has been weaponized. Here today to tell us about it and the front lines of the war on truth and democracy is Tim Carr from Free Press. Good day to you, Tim.
Hi, Stephen. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Good. I'm just going to tell people a little bit about you. You're the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, a nonprofit, and you build on your grassroots and policy work to promote universal access to open and affordable networks, challenge commercial media concentration, and rethink the future of journalism. Before joining Free Press, Tim worked in media as an award-winning photojournalist, also as an editor, reporter, and he's published throughout the world. We're listening to Tim Carr from Free Press. Now, the internet, we think, is governed by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, but that may not be true. So tell us a little bit about what the FCC is. Do they actually look over the internet, and what is their role? And we're going to talk about the new FCC chairman here, Brandon Carr, right?
Yes, well, this is where things get a little complicated, because the Federal Communications Commission, which was created in the 1930s really as an agency that provided oversight for radio, and then it expanded to include radio and television and cable access. It is an agency that has historically had limited ability to regulate internet content. Now, the 1996 Telecommunications Act actually has written into law an authority called Title II. Title II authority allows the Federal Communications Commission to have oversight over internet access. So there's a difference between internet access services. Those are the services that an internet service provider like AT&T or Comcast or Verizon provides you. They give you a connection to the internet. But once you're online, the way you visit websites, the way you visit services online, that is beyond the control. The FCC cannot tell you what websites are available. That we have a law rule in place, or we had a rule in place under Title II. So basically ISPs have to provide access to the internet, but they cannot discriminate over the types of websites and services people choose to go to. It's like, for example, I mean, it's this idea of common carriage. When you pick up the telephone is a common carrier, and you call your local pizza joint, the telephone company cannot reroute your call to Domino's because they have a special deal with Domino's. The same thing happens with the internet. Once you're online, you get to pick what websites and services you want to use. The authority that the FCC has to protect an open internet comes under Title II. The Trump administration repealed Title II rules the first time around. They've been reinstated and challenged in court. So we now face a situation, one, where we don't have net neutrality, but the second part of it, and which just gets to the other point, is the FCC chairman appointed by Trump, Brendan Carr, wants to extend his agency's authority, not just to include the ability to regulate platforms that are on the internet. These are companies like Meta, which of course owns Facebook and Instagram, companies like Alphabet, which controls Google, and YouTube, TikTok. He wants to, Brendan Carr, the FCC chair, wants the ability to regulate these companies because conservatives in the Trump administration believe that they've been actively censoring conservative voices. So he's actually looking for the power to really censor these companies, to censor their ability to moderate content, their ability to choose their own policies, and set their own community standards over what type of content goes over their own private social networks. And so I know that's a very long explanation, but essentially we have in Brendan Carr a Trump's censor in chief. And it's not only these platform companies like Meta and Google that he's going after, but he's also going after traditional news companies. He has enabled a complaint against CBS. Trump is now suing CBS because they allege that 60 Minutes had edited a then Vice President Harris interview in ways that were unfair. And so Carr would like the authority to pressure broadcast companies like CBS, like ABC, like NBC to abide by Trump or face consequences. Now, those consequences potentially could be the removal of their or the denial of their broadcast licenses so that they can no longer broadcast their programming over the air. So we have a very aggressive effort by Trump's FCC chair to extend his authority over all media to ensure that they are all towing the Trump line. And that's why we call Brendan Carr Trump's censorship czar, because he is essentially violating his oath to the Constitution to turn the First Amendment on its ear and use his office to pressure media outlet to be essentially propaganda for the Trump administration.
All right, let me just clarify here. We're speaking to Tim Carr from Free Press, who is no relation at all to Brendan Carr, who's the head of FCC. Again, there's no relation. It's spelled differently. All right. In the case for Kamala Harris, they said that they had to release the raw footage, and then 60 Minutes did release the raw footage. What was the response?
Carr had asked CBS to release the entire transcript of an interview, and what the transcripts show is that the CBS 60 Minute editors shortened a lengthy interview so it fit their broadcast program format. To edit interviews like this is a very common practice across all journalism, but Trump alleged that CBS was biasing in favor of Harris by editing her interview so that her responses seemed to favor her over Trump. And so it's a trumped up charge, a ludicrous charge that enabled Carr then to take a complaint that was filed by a conservative organization and start a proceeding at the FCC to investigate what CBS has done. And it's ridiculous, because what CBS was doing, what 60 Minutes was doing, was a very common practice, common to newsrooms. But the Trump administration, through Brendan Carr, saw an opportunity to pressure very influential news outlet, 60 Minutes, and with the intended goal of intimidating them so that they would, you know, no longer challenge Trump's agenda. And so we filed a number of days ago, we filed our response at the FCC, really basically calling out how ridiculous and really unconstitutional this FCC proceeding was, and calling on the FCC to dismiss the complaint that was filed against CBS.
Yes, and over at Paramount, they gave in and they scrapped the AI, and then Verizon was also investigated.
Yeah, I mean, Paramount has yet to give in on Paramount and CBS. Paramount is the parent company for CBS, but ABC, which is owned by Disney, did settle a lawsuit that Trump brought that was based on another ridiculous claim. So I think, you know, one of the reasons that Free Press began more than 20 years ago was in reaction to a book one of our co-founders, Bob McChesney, wrote called Rich Media, Poor Democracy. And our concern is that consolidated media companies, these very large media companies like Disney, like News Corp, Fox, now billionaire-controlled media like Meta, like X Corp, like even the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, these very large media conglomerates have such extensive conflicts of interest across their media empires. For example, if you look at the Washington Post owner, Jeff Bezos, he also owns a space exploration company called Blue Origin that has contracts with the government. And so when Bob McChesney wrote the book Rich Media, Poor Democracy 20 years ago, he foresaw what was going to happen, that if you have these massive media conglomerates that are constantly have their hands out for what to government, whether it's for favorable policies or for contracts for some of their other businesses, their news divisions become feckless. They become toothless. They don't want to challenge power. We're seeing that now, an administration that doesn't have respect, it's called for the media, it's called journalism, the enemy of the American people, is now using that power to threaten these massive conglomerates to toe the line. And they're also using it in the case of Musk, as we discussed earlier, to also award those conglomerates that do. The Musk Starlink internet access program is being rewarded with billions of dollars potentially in contracts in exchange for the favorable Trump coverage that you can find on X, where Musk amplifies pro-Trump tweets, including his own.
All right, just to remind people here, you're listening to WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, and WVPV in Bradenton, Florida, and we're talking to Tim Carr about our assault, the war on truth and democracy. We're just talking about some print media things. So let's talk about local news and why that's the frontline trenches for the war on truth.
Absolutely. We believe that the answer to the problem of billionaire-controlled media, the way you can billionaire the proof the media, is by breaking up large conglomerates, by preventing these massive media mergers from occurring, but you can also support local independent media. And so we have an active program at Free Press to look at state level, local policies to support local independent news. Increasingly, there are a number of non-commercial news models that we're looking at because we've seen that commercial interests, like those that dominate some of these larger conglomerates, can undermine a news outlet's ability to, you know, to use the saying about journalism to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That is the purpose of journalism. The purpose of the Fourth Estate is to challenge power in the interests of democracy. And so our belief is that you need a more robust non-commercial media sector. You need more robust public funding for news production in order to see that sort of independence, that sort of that comes out of smaller operations that don't have these sprawling conflicts of interest. So we have just published a report on local news policies that states can take up, that even cities can take up, that would support independent local journalism, non-commercial journalism, so we can start to build out that sector. And it's worth reminding people that the United States payments or the funding for public media is woefully inadequate when compared to other Western democracies. Even democracies in Asia have per capita pay much more into their public media sector. So they have more robust public media systems that act in many ways as an antidote to hyper-commercial media, which, as we're seeing over the past several months, has failed to really step up and act as a bulwark against the type of authoritarianism that we're seeing unfolding every day in the United States.
And every day here at WSLR and WPPV, we have our news team and our public funding vanished. So we are also seeing the front lines here. All right, so Tim, on our way out today, you've given us a lot of information. There's been Tim Carr speaking to us, the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Just give us a little wisdom on the way out here, Tim.
Sure. I mean, I would say that if you really care about these things, if you care about democracy, you have to care about having an independent media system. And that's the reason that Free Press exists, to create – a media system, a just and equitable media system that supports democracy. And we believe strongly that one way to do that is to create a more robust public funding mechanism for the media, so that your news program and others that are working in communities have the means to continue reporting and challenging authority. So if you're interested in learning more about that, I would encourage your listeners to go to freepress.net, where we have lots of information.
Great. And again, my name is Steve Norris. You're listening to Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications from Free Press, on WSLR and WBPV today, talking to us about how we're on the front lines of the war on truth and democracy. Thank you so much, Tim. Have a good day.
My pleasure.
Foreign illnesses and deaths in the U.S. worsening. New data on recalls explain. Despite headlines, there were fewer food recalls in 2024 than in 2023, but more people died from food poisoning linked to the outbreaks. Food recalls seemed relentless in the U.S. last year. Cucumbers, eggs, even big brand products such as McDonald's Quarter Pounders and Boar's Head deli meats were implicated in dozens of foodborne illnesses, leaving many questioning whether their foods were safe to eat. But surprisingly, the total number of recalls issued by federal agencies in 2024 actually declined from the previous year, according to a new report published by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, a nonprofit advocacy group. What did worsen was the severity of the outbreaks, with hospitalizations and deaths linked to contaminated foods doubling from the previous year. And experts say these numbers only capture a small fraction of foodborne illnesses occurring nationwide. Food safety oversight in the U.S. is split between two agencies. One is the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which regulates more than three quarters of the food supply, including dairy, produce, and packaged foods. The other is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees meat, poultry, and some egg products. In 2024, the two agencies announced 296 recalls, a 5% decrease from 2023. The biggest cause of recalls in 2024 was bacterial contamination, followed by undisclosed allergens such as peanuts and tree nuts. But whether food is becoming less safe generally is more complicated to determine. Less than 5% of all foodborne illnesses are linked to an outbreak with an identified source. The deadliest outbreak in 2024 involved Boar's Head deli meats, which were associated with 60 hospitalizations and 10 deaths across 19 states. Inspectors reported numerous violations at the company's plant in Virginia, including unsanitary conditions, which likely contributed to the outbreak. Listeria monocytogenes, the bacteria deemed responsible, can survive in cold environments and remain on surfaces for long periods of time, making it more resilient than other pathogens. In February, the FDA announced a recall of frozen shakes delivered to hospitals and care facilities for listeria contamination, involving a year-old food illness mystery. The frozen shakes were linked to 12 deaths across 21 states going back to 2018, highlighting the challenge of tracing foodborne illnesses to their sources. In an op-ed for Fox News published on March 2nd, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. downplayed the importance of vaccines, saying the MMR jab provides protection against measles, while also calling vaccination a personal choice. He also claimed that vitamin A supplementation has been shown to dramatically reduce measles mortality. Since the publication of that op-ed, many experts have sounded the alarm on that plug for vitamin A. The research RFK Jr. referenced does exist, but there's important context missing. The analysis he cited focuses on studies that mostly looked at low-income countries where many people have vitamin A deficiencies. According to the CDC, less than 1% of people in the U.S. have a vitamin A deficiency. Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, told the Washington Post that vitamin A can play a role in treating children who are hospitalized with measles, but he and other experts conveyed concerns to the Post about RFK's framing, creating a false equivalency between vaccination, which is extremely effective, and vitamin supplementation, which may or may not help children avoid complications from measles. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently put out a statement emphasizing that vitamin A supplementation is no substitute for vaccination and that it should be only conducted under the supervision of medical professionals. Vitamin A overdoses can cause bone fractures, liver damage, and other serious issues. The Pentagon starts purging climate change measures. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wants to end the Pentagon's climate efforts. Many experts say the move could hurt military readiness. Last week, the Pentagon announced it had canceled multiple studies related to climate, including several that sought to determine whether a hotter planet could lead to more instability in Africa. In addition, the Defense Department has spent the last few weeks combing outside contracts for the term climate, with the intent to zero out all related work, according to two former Pentagon officials. The purge is being driven broadly by President Trump, who previously has described climate change as a hoax, but has taken on extra urgency under the leadership of Defense Secretary Hegseth, who has long rejected climate science and has vowed to eliminate all the Pentagon's climate-related work. It's unclear how many climate initiatives are at risk for cancellation and how much money their erasure would save. The Pentagon said canceling 91 studies on climate and other topics would save $30 million, but it did not disclose how much money the Defense Department could save by eliminating other climate-related programs and studies. Pentagon officials did not respond to questions from Politico News seeking answers on these topics. Instead, they issued a statement that said the Defense Department was working to restore the warrior ethos and refocus our military on its core mission of deterring, fighting, and winning wars.
Well, we finally know why plants grow towards the light. And this was published in the Cold Spring Harbor Labs magazine. Scientists finally figured out how plants know where light is coming from. We've known that plants are phototropic, which means they bend towards sunlight. For example, simple experiments with seedlings that grow towards the light. But until 2023, we didn't know how they did it. The answer came from an accidental discovery. Researchers found that plants with a mutation in a protein transporter called ABCG5 could not follow the light. Well, in human beings, this mutation of a protein transporter deficiency causes cytosterolemia, which is impairing the elimination of plant steroids from the body. The gene is important to help plants create air pockets. As it turns out, plants rely on tiny air pockets inside them to scatter light and create gradient that tells them which way to grow. No air pockets, no phototropism. We now know how plants grow towards light. And now stay tuned for a Jim Hightower lowdown.
Last week, the Democratic Party's top congressional leaders finally took a bold stand against Trump's assault on our democracy when he came to Congress to tout his autocratic agenda. Traditionally, when a president arrives to address Congress, a bipartisan escort committee leads the dignitary to the podium. But by gollies, Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries showed their toughness by, get this, refusing to have Democrats join the escort committee. Wow, imagine how that uplifted the millions of people being stomped on by Trump's rampage. Is this feeble response better than nothing? Believe it or not, doing nothing is another strategy proposed by former Bill Clinton operative James Carville. He says the smart thing for Democrats to do is to roll over and play dead. Seriously, Carville actually declares that fighting Trump is futile. So just allow the Republicans to crumble beneath their own weight and make the American people miss us. Excuse me, but wasn't that the party's theory in 2016 and 2024? Let Trump rant and he'll defeat himself. Instead, how about this? Literally, get out of Washington. The party's lawmakers should spend most of their congressional time away from the Capitol, out where masses of people are already agitating and organizing. Get with them, listen to them, roll up your sleeves, and serve them. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is not just another legislative tiff we're in, but a grassroots rumble, and the usual partisan name-calling and parliamentary nitpicking won't win it. Inside Washington, the deck is stacked for Trump's autocratic America. Out here, though, the numbers and political dynamic favor democracy fighters. This is where the Democratic Party belongs. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack.
You are listening to WSLR 96.5 Low Power FM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 in Bradenton, Florida. Next is former CIA analyst and whistleblower Mel Goodman to discuss the Sovietization of the United States. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you in these very difficult times.
Indeed. So Mel Goodman, just to let you know, he's also a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He's a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst and whistleblower. He's the author, and his columns are available at counterpunch.org. Well, as we know, as hypocrisy rises, our institutions are failing and falling. Please report, Mel, on what you see and what it means.
Well, I think what we've been saying, that this country is distinguished by certain characteristics that have kept our democracy alive for 250 years. And we talk about the rule of law, we talk about governance and civil society and the courts and the Constitution that will keep our democracy going. But what we've learned in just 2 months now since the inauguration of Donald Trump is that our democracy is failing. And the great debate, of course, is are we in a constitutional crisis or is this just a run-up to a constitutional dilemma or a constitutional problem, and that's what's divided the Democratic Party. And we know that Senator Chuck Schumer is in a lot of trouble in part because he doesn't believe there's a constitutional crisis. Well, there is. And one of the institutions of the democracy, particularly our democracy, but it's true for any democracy around the world, is the importance of the press. And what we're seeing at the Washington Post particularly, and the audacious hypocrisy of the Washington Post, is truly alarming. The Post is owned by one of the richest men in the world. Apparently, Elon Musk is only richer than Jeff Bezos. And he's been censoring the Post, censoring editorials, censoring editorial cartoons, for that matter, and laying out new rules for what could be the topics of op-ed writing and editorial writing. So just before the election, in November, it was in late October, the Washington Post editorial staff had put together a very important editorial endorsing the candidacy of Kamala Harris for president of the United States. When this was shown to Jeff Bezos, he gave the order to kill it. And that's what the editor of the editorial page, David Shipley, did. This led to a lot of cancellations of the newspaper, maybe several hundred thousand. It led to some writers leaving, but it didn't stop there. Because then you had a cartoon by a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist named Ann Telness, who lampooned Jeff Bezos for going to Mar-a-Lago to have dinner with Donald and Melania, and also then donating $1 million to the inaugural committee of the Trump presidency. She, at least, did the right thing. She resigned from the paper. Jennifer Rubin, a very important editorial writer, left in the wake of Ann Telness and that terrible situation. Then there were other articles that were killed, including one by the media critic. But the departure that should stun people was the one by Ruth Marcus. With the retirement of Linda Greenhouse at the New York Times several years ago, who was the leading writer on the courts in the mainstream media, leading writer on jurisprudence in the United States, for that matter, Ruth Marcus really took the mantle in that situation. And I think she became the leading and the most authoritative critic. Well, she had an editorial killed, and those who are curious about this, who get the New Yorker, go into the New Yorker app, and you'll find her explanation of what happened, as well as her editorial that was censored by the editor of the paper. So it goes on and on and on. And in a New York Times columnist, David Brooks said, the opinion section in the Washington Post no longer brooks dissent. That's just not journalism. And one thing I added that I think is not well known, Common Cause and the Southern Poverty Law Center negotiated a contract for about $100,000 to run a full-page ad asking the question, who's running this country, Donald Trump or Elon Musk? The contract went through all of the commercial and business divisions of the Washington Post, but then it was killed at the editorial level. So if you can't have a free press, which Thomas Jefferson said had to be Article Number One because it's the most important aspect of protecting our democracy, then we're not going to have a free society. And a similar situation didn't get as much attention because there weren't the big names involved, like with the Post, names that were well-known nationally. But you, again, had a publisher of the Los Angeles Times who made his millions and billions of dollars in getting medical instruments approved by the government, the FDA, and other elements of the government. He killed editorials that were critical of Donald Trump, and there were resignations and lost circulation there as well. But the key is really, how free is our press? Are we going to have dissent? Are we going to have opinion writers expressing their views, which is what we want in a newspaper? I read the New York Times and the Washington Post on a daily basis because I teach a course that deals with international relations in the press, and I write about the press. But I must say, with the exception of the New York Times, I just don't see another newspaper that's allowing the kind of dissent that we need in order to have a full discussion of what's happening in this country. And what's happening in this country is extremely ugly. And we can cite various events, including the arrest of Khalil at Columbia University, who was whisked off to a secret prison in Louisiana. He hasn't been able to talk to anyone. He hasn't been able to talk to his lawyers. No charges have been filed. This has been covered amply by the New York Times. But when a group of progressive senators circulated a resolution denouncing the deportation of Khalil, only 14 Democrats signed that resolution. Once you allow political prisoners to be taken in this country, you're reaching the level of the Soviet Union. That's why I wrote a piece on the Sovietization of the United States, because this is what you're seeing. If you're going after the press, if you're going after media, you have the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. He started investigations of ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, NPR. Funding to NPR is probably going to be cut off. So we have some unprecedented activities going on in this country with Donald Trump defying the courts. And I would consider that part of the Sovietization. It's an ugly downward glide path that we're on, where courts can be confronted by Trump, orders can be ignored. Trump himself is now talking about impeaching judges. You've never had a judge impeached in this country for political or ideological reasons or because of a particular decision. There have been about 12 or 15 over the 250 years of U.S. history, but they've all been for things like bribery or fraud, you know, civil statutes, genuine crimes that were committed, not for decisions that were taken. And then finally, in terms of the Sovietization, look what just happened over the last few days. A judge gave an order, a Maryland judge, my state, to stop the deportation of 250 members of what were supposed to be South American gangs, the MS-13 gang in El Salvador and the Tren de Aragua gang in Venezuela. They were whisked off. The judge gave the order that the plane should not leave the ground. If they've left the ground, they have to turn back. The two planes that were in the air did not turn back, and the third plane, which hadn't taken off yet, took off after the written order was given by the judge himself. This is Judge Boasberg, who's a very distinguished judge, who was appointed originally by George W. Bush, elevated to the federal bench by Barack Obama, served on the National Surveillance Court, which is a very prestigious position. And the interesting thing is he went to Yale Law School, and his roommate was Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. So terrible things are happening, and nothing is being done about it at the political level. And the only thing we're counting on is the courts, but the courts have limited means to enforce decisions. So for the first time in history, and this is, to me, the final step, I think we're in a constitutional crisis already, but for those who don't think we are, the final step will be the possibility that Donald Trump will defy a decision of the Supreme Court. This has never been done in the history of the United States. When Richard Nixon was told by the court to give up the Watergate tapes, he gave them up. When Harry Truman was told he couldn't seize the steel mills during the Korean War, he stopped what he was doing. When FDR was told he couldn't expand the court in the 1930s, he stopped his decision to expand the court. Even Abraham Lincoln, who was threatening habeas corpus, when he was told he couldn't threaten habeas corpus, he stopped what he was doing. Trump is moving in a direction where I think we're going to see the defiance of a court decision. And then no one can deny that this country is facing something unprecedented, which is a constitutional constitutional crisis. So with the exception of the Civil War itself in the 1860s, we have never seen this kind of threat to our democracy and to our republic. And I find it extremely frightening to see which way this country is going.
All right, we're listening to Mel Goodman, who's a whistleblower, and his columns are available at counterpunch.org about the Sovietization of the United States. And, of course, today we had Trump meeting with Putin. This is being recorded on Wednesday. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is about Bezos and the libertarian view. And you write a little bit about his libertarian views. Does that come into play? Is that an important factor here?
That's a very important factor because he issued a directive to his editorial board that he only wants editorials on two subjects, personal liberty and free markets. Well, those are the libertarian positions, and it's the libertarians who are giving tremendous support to Donald Trump because they want smaller government. They want no regulations. They want to eliminate the regulatory agencies. And what you've seen from the Trump administration, and it's supported by people like Jeff Bezos, is look what's happening at the Environmental Protection Agency. Look what's happening at the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Look at what's happening in the IRS, where you're going to have severe personnel cuts that will limit the ability to conduct audits of very rich people and big businesses. So on the level of libertarian thinking to reduce the government, remember that Trump himself, his major backer in his run for the White House in 2016, the first time he was elected president, even though he didn't have a popular mandate, Hillary Clinton had 3 million more votes, he had the support of Steve Bannon, the ideologue who wants to destroy the administrative state. And that's what we're seeing on a gradual basis. But what we're also seeing is the courts beginning to push back. The court ruled today about the moves that were made against the Agency for International Development, that they were illegal and had to be turned back, and that aid money had to be distributed. The problem is whenever these decisions are announced, we never know if the aid money is really being sent out. My inclination is that it hasn't been, and that there's no way of enforcing this. Remember, to enforce a decision of the Supreme Court, say if someone were held in contempt of a decision by the court, people like the so-called border czar, Tom Homan, or the deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, who were very dangerous individuals. Well, to move against these people, and certainly to threaten them in some way, or even to jail them in some way for contempt of a federal decision, you would need the federal marshals. Or who do the federal marshals point to follow, adhere to? That would be the President of the United States. And even if they were convicted in court, you know damn well they would receive pardons from a president who's already pardoned over 1,000 people who were involved in the insurrection of January the 6th, 2021. So, again, we're in an alarming situation. A coup is being mounted. One was mounted on January the 6th in 2021, with incredible violence. Here, without any violence, without the use of the military, without the use of arms, the government of the United States is being challenged and weakened on a regular basis. And one of the elements that I haven't touched on yet that needs to be mentioned is what's happening at elite universities, getting them to kowtow to the president. Columbia University is a perfect example. They did everything that Trump wanted them to do, which involved, in part, restricting free speech on the campus of Columbia. And they still lost $400 million in federal grants, most of which was devoted to AID contracts to help the situation involving health issues and pandemics in Africa, in the global south, where you could have pandemics that could easily spread to Western Europe and the United States, just as COVID went from China to Europe, the Netherlands, and then to New York and the United States. This is AID, Agency for International Development, that's working in a way that benefits the United States. So it is so incredibly small-minded and shows such incredible ignorance and, need I say, stupidity on the people around Trump. But they are so enthused with their own power and their own ability now to limit government and to secure every branch of government in terms of their own interests. They have the House, they have the Senate, in a sense they have the courts, even though there's a sign that Chief Justice Roberts is getting impatient because he denounced Trump's remarks that talk about impeaching a justice because of a decision he made. That's one of the first glimmers of hope that Roberts has grown a spine somehow and will not stick with the ultra-conservatives on the court like Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas particularly, but also Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. So I hate to keep saying it, but we are in troubled waters.
All right, Mel, as we're talking about the Sovietization of the United States, it looks like there are some foreign models that we should look at. We know Hungary is of interest to Trump and also some other countries. Tell us about that.
Well, clearly the countries that are of interest to Trump are the ones led by authoritarian leaders. And as you look around the world, democracy's in retreat. Let's face it, this is not unique to the United States, what's happening. We're seeing it all over Western Europe, and we're seeing it in other parts of the world. So if you look at very important countries, India has the third largest economy in the world, trailing only the United States and China. Well, Modi is an authoritarian. If you look at Turkey, Erdogan was elected. He's an authoritarian. The leader of Argentina is an authoritarian. In Hungary, you have an anti-Semitic authoritarian, Viktor Orban, who's gone after George Soros and other Jewish luminaries in a very threatening way. Slovakia, again, an authoritarian. And I haven't even mentioned people like Putin and Xi Jinping, and Benjamin Netanyahu, for that matter. If you look at the actions he's taken and the resumption of the genocidal attack on Gaza that he resumed on Tuesday of this week, where 400 more people were killed, most of them civilians, as he's sidled more closely with the right wing of his party in order to keep his coalition together, in order to keep himself in the office of the prime minister, in order to stay out of jail because he's facing criminal charges over bribery and influence peddling. So you've got a vice president like J.D. Vance, who's reached out to right-wing parties in East and West Europe. He even met with the sort of Nazi-style Alternative for Germany, the pro-Russian party that doubled its vote in the last election. I don't think it'll be part of the new coalition, but the German coalition will be the weakest in German history since the end of World War II. And the Alternative for Germany is right there on the edge of things because they doubled their vote in one election. And clearly where they're prominent is in the former region of communist Germany, that's East Germany, and there they're the most popular party. So you have just a series of important individuals around the world, Le Pen in France. You have the right wing prominent in the Netherlands, in Denmark, more prominent in Sweden. We're seeing it in East and West Germany. And that's at a time when the United States has weakened the European alliance, the Western alliance, by cutting off aid for a period of time to Ukraine. The aid has now been restored, but Ukraine paid a terrible price when they weren't getting defensive missiles that they needed to fight Putin's war of terrorism. So there are great costs associated with all of this. And another threatening trend that people aren't paying enough attention to is that countries like France and Germany, but also Italy and Spain, are so alarmed by the fact that Trump may pull out of NATO, out of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, may pull out of support for the European community. European states are on their own. France, of course, has a mini deterrent in terms of a couple hundred nuclear weapons, and they're talking about providing a nuclear umbrella for Germany. And Germany's talking about, well, maybe it shouldn't be a nuclear umbrella. Maybe we should develop our own nuclear weapons. And at the same time in Asia, Japan and South Korea are so alarmed with Trump's retreat from global security and the Western alliance, you're getting talk for the first time in Japan about building nuclear weapons and South Korea. So having gotten some control over the proliferation of nuclear weapons, we're now in an era where countries that never thought they would need nuclear weapons are thinking maybe they need some kind of deterrence. And we've been lucky in that regard because most projections were that by this time in the 21st century, there would probably be two dozen nuclear powers. Well, there are only nine, and it's the same nine for the most part that we've seen for the last 20 years. And the last thing we need is more countries with nuclear weapons. It's horrific enough to think that someone like Donald Trump and his lack of stability, his lack of acuity, his lack of knowledge about nuclear weapons is in control of the nuclear button. And remember his conversations with Kim Il-sung in his first term, brandishing the idea that I've got a bigger button than you, which was pure Trump speak. His false sense of masculinity and talking about the size of his nuclear button. I mean, there's a certain madness going on at the top ranks of the U.S. government, and it's threatening to all of us.
All right, you've been listening to Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst, talking to us about the Sovietization of the United States. And just in a minute that we have left, Mel, can you give us some hope?
give you some hope? Well, right now I have no more bad news. I don't know if that's hopeful. I guess the greatest hope I have right now is the news that we're getting of these town hall meetings going on around the country, in the center of the country, but also in the northeast and on the western coast, that Republican representatives are starting to get an earful because people are disgusted with the idea that Elon Musk, I don't know if he's the second most powerful man in the United States. I think he's the co-president. He's been unleashed by Donald Trump because Donald Trump has no ideas whatsoever about governance, and Elon Musk wants to destroy government so he can get his contracts and add billions and billions of dollars to his wealth. So the hope is that the people will get up off their bottoms, that the Democratic Party will heal its dispute over whether we're in a constitutional crisis or not, find new leadership, and become a real opposition. Without these two things happening, now we're waiting and can only wait for the congressional elections of 2026. That's a long time to wait when you see how much damage has been done in 2 months.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mel. And this has been Steve Norris reporting for WSLR and WBPV News.
CDC's planned vaccine autism study is raising eyebrows. Experts raise concerns about the CDC's plan to use the Vaccine Safety Data Link, VSD, to look for an association between vaccines and autism, despite decades of data demonstrating the two are not linked. Gregory Polland, the former editor-in-chief of the journal Vaccine, says there were 28 studies about vaccines and autism that had been done across two or three decades across multiple countries. The two hallmarks of science, he says, are generalizability, so in different populations, different countries, different time frames, and repeatability, Dr. Pollan told MedPages. Every single one of those studies has shown no association. Not all 28 studies have been of equally high value, but some have used superb study design. One of the largest was a population-based study of more than 537,000 children in Denmark, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which showed the risk of autism diagnosis was similar between those who received the measles, mumps, and rubella MMR vaccine than those who did not. So there could be a belief, an ideological one, that would just keep going until studies give the response that one is looking for, and that is called ideology, not science.
You've been listening to Surreal News on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. I want to thank the co-hosts Nancy Norris and Lou Larini, and author Melvin Goodman, who discussed the Sovietization of the U.S., and also Tim Carr of Free Press on how the FCC is weaponizing media. Don't touch that dial. Stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Then after that, Complex Waveforms with Mark Zampella.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. And rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was a sounding. This land was made for you and me. There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. Sign was painted, said private property, but on the backside.